We hope, just a word of explanation, we hope to break the discussion into two parts. In the first part, there will be a kind of public presentation open to the media, and then we'll give the media an opportunity to pack up and end the public session. But I think there'll be something of real interest to all of us. Mrs. Selma Roosevelt, Lucky Roosevelt, is the widow of a legendary figure in the field of history and foreign policy and intelligence, Archie Roosevelt, the grandson of Theodore Roosevelt. However, her achievements stand as noteworthy entirely on their own. She established herself as a leading journalist. She wrote the piece that came to the president's attention, responding to a critic early in the administration, and as a result served for 7 years, more than any other chief of protocol in our history. And subsequently authored a book which I would commend to everyone present as a most revealing account. The greatest strength of the book is that one sets it down hoping that someday she'll tell us even more, because as one reads behind the lines, there is a significant story to tell that is of interest to an institution such as the Miller Center that is engaged in a Reagan oral history. She had the unique opportunity to work not only as chief of protocol to the president, but also to Secretary of State Shultz. And this combination opened up the governance of the Reagan administration and its foreign policy as perhaps no other experience could do. It's a great opportunity for us to visit with Mrs. Roosevelt this morning, and she has a few questions that she'll comment on at the opening of our discussion.
Thank you so much. Well, I'm very honored and really quite thrilled to be here today. I love this place. I know it rather well from my youth. My Lebanese ancestors settled in this area and in Tennessee, where I grew up. And so as a child, I used to spend a lot of time here and admired this wonderful university, thought it was the most beautiful place I'd ever been. And it was sort of an ideal in my mind. So you can imagine the pleasure I have in coming back here today. Would you like me to begin with?
Please, yeah.
First, just a word about why I wrote this book. Many people think that protocol and the job that I had is sort of a glorified Miss Manners. And that rather annoyed me. And after doing it for 7 years and working harder than I have ever worked in my life, and hours that were unbelievable, as does everyone who works in the White House. I mean, it's not unique to me, but there is very little that you don't have to be involved in that's going on in the White House or the State Department, and your work covers both. And it is not Miss Manners, believe me. It is nothing to do with the problems of seating and protocol and precedence that you think. Naturally, they're there, and they're little things that come up every day. But the overall job was far more than I, who had lived in Washington for 40 years, been married to a member of the CIA, an understate cover, where as a State Department's wife, that's what people thought I was. I naturally had to know a lot about protocol and all the things that go on in that side of diplomatic life. In any case, the book is an attempt to teach and show a little bit about what the job is, and I will get into that more in a minute, and why it gives you a fantastic perspective on what's going on in the government. I used to feel the one thing that I'll never forget is that whatever I read on the front page, let's say on Wednesday, was what I'd been doing on Tuesday, but not publicly. I mean, obviously, I wasn't the main player. I and my staff and the people that were working were the people that were behind the scenes of that big event that was going on, like the visit of Mulroney or the visit of Gorbachev or whoever it might be. We had already experienced that, and then we were reading it the next day. And so that gives you some idea that of the excitement of the job as well. And you begin to be a bit of a junkie because your life is centered around world leaders and what's going on every day and the political implications of what you're doing. And it's totally different, as I said, from the mismanners that some people think. In addition, one of the jobs that I had to do and deal with a great deal was a question of diplomatic immunity and the question of our treaty obligations to every nation in the world. And we had a lot of trouble with that, which I'll go into eventually. The attempt on the part of the Congress to micromanage the State Department, which is one of the things that I saw and experienced at great length, and one of the things that I feel very strongly now is needs to be redressed. I think we have too many secretaries of state, 500 or so of them in the Congress, and I think that's become intolerable. I think the executive has to reassert itself in foreign policy, and again, these are things that I experienced and saw in my realm, which was the question of diplomatic immunity and the question of how we deal with our diplomatic corps in Washington. And, of course, I saw it before Secretary of State dealing with it every day. Then, on another side of things, one of the things that I had to be responsible for and was a unique experience for a chief of protocol under any administration was the restoration of the government's guest house, the Blair House. Now, that's an odd thing, but it has a very important impact on foreign policy and foreign relations. The presidential guest house across the street from the White House is the first and only house that foreigners see when they come to America. So usually they go from one public building to another, and the White House, of course. But this house is on a scale, is to human scale. And it was, incidentally, falling apart, and we weren't going to be able to use it much longer, and some people in the Congress wanted to tear it down. And so my job was, one, to get it restored. It's 110 rooms, four houses, seamlessly now together. But 6 or 8 years ago, they were four separate houses. And what we did, and what I had to do, was in addition to the normal job of a chief of protocol. The reason I stayed the 7 years, frankly, was to see that job through, because it is something that I'm very proud of, and I know all of you care a lot about historic preservation. We saved that set of structures, and it's probably the second most beautiful house in the country now. I take no credit for the decor. That was done by two master decorators, but I do feel that the management job that was involved is what. And now we have something we can be very proud of and that does advertise us as a nation to our foreign visitors. Now, I've sort of given you a little overall view of what this book is, some of the things this book is about and why I care. I haven't talked about the presidency as much as you'd like. I'll do that now. My association with Ronald Reagan began very casually as a journalist. I was I was the junior person of the Washington Post group that was went to the 1968 convention in Miami, and Ronald Reagan was just a vague character at that point. Very few people knew anything about him, but there was talk that he was thinking of running for the president, or he was trying to run for the president, and so on. And nobody took it very seriously, but they still thought they better cover this candidate, or a possible candidate. I was a junior reporter, and I was assigned the Reagan beat, because that wasn't considered very important. I was, more specifically, I found myself assigned to Nancy Reagan. And that was not considered important, obviously, either. And so I attended press conferences where she was, and I then interviewed her in a one-on-one. And even then, it's very interesting how, if you believe in God and the fates and all these things that I believe in, that all was meant to be. Because my sympathy went out to her. Not that she's a sympathetic character, because, I mean, she's not someone that you know, she's not a warm person. But I felt terrific sympathy for her, because she was so inarticulate and found it hard to talk to this group of people who had assembled to interview her. I was with the New York Times correspondent, Charlotte Curtis, who'd been my roommate at Vassar's, the two of us from next to each other. And we were struck that here's a very lovely, beautiful woman, beautifully turned out, and probably the most sophisticated of all the wives, a former actress who undoubtedly knew, had presence and so on, and yet she was very, very shy and very inarticulate, and I had a certain sympathy for her. I don't know why. And then I interviewed her later. I wrote an article about that interview, and it was basically, I think, sympathetic to her. And the Washington Post did not print the story I wrote. The next day, the story was a conglomerate of my story and the Associated Press story, and maybe the United Press, put together. And so I was absolutely furious. And I went in to see how Mr. Simon, then person in charge of our convention coverage, and I said, how dare you put my byline on an article I didn't write? And he apologized, looked into it, found out it was wrong. In any case, what happened was that was my first introduction to Nancy Reagan, and I sent a letter to her with my article enclosed, what I had actually written, because I was so annoyed. That was ages ago. Never dreaming that she would ever one day, it was just a coincidence in a way. And that was 1968. I never thought about her again until 1980, when the Reagans came to Washington. And I'd covered the president only when he'd come to Washington to give a speech at the press club, and so that was the only time I'd ever met him. I'd never really had much to do with him. And so, in 1980, they came to Washington. I'm a Republican. I come from a well-known Republican family. My husband was the grandson of Theodore Roosevelt. So it was quite natural that we all met each other, got to know each other, and so on in Washington. And my husband and I did live in Washington all our married life, except when we were abroad. So we knew everybody, and of course, the way Washington's almost a village. You go to parties and you meet people and so on. I met the Reagans quite early in their arrival. I met Mike Deaver, who was very instrumental in my being suggested for the job. And the president, I doubt if he had any particular idea of putting me in this job. I think it was Mike Deaver and probably Nancy Reagan who were responsible for it. The president, I liked him the minute I met him and got to know him, and I had a very warm relationship with him. I always did. And I had a very pleasant relationship with Mrs. Reagan as a social relationship. Then, I saw them at, I suppose, at their best, and I thought she was on her way to doing a very good job as First Lady. I particularly was impressed with what she had done in her attempts to refurbish the White House. The upstairs quarters, particularly, they'd been allowed to go into great disrepair. The Congress never appropriates money for these things, so they have to, every now and then, an interested party has to get in there and do something and raise the money privately. Mrs. Reagan did, and she got terribly criticized. You know, that was the beginning of the criticism of Nancy Reagan. She also got criticized about the China, which of course was just an outrage, because all it was a gift from a very patriotic American who she didn't know and she didn't solicit, who decided she wanted to give this gift of $200,000 worth of fabulous China to the government, to the country, to the White House. She did it, and Nancy Reagan accepted it on behalf of a grateful nation. And all she got for it was the most terrible press that's ever been, I think, for a First Lady. Well, this is when I got indignant. Again, I wrote my article. And this article I wrote without any other thought than this woman wasn't getting a fair break. And the article was published on the front, on the op-ed page of the Washington Post, which, as you all know, I'm sure you all read it, is a very widely read page. And it was right smack in the center. And it said, "Give the First Lady a break. She hasn't been in office a year. She's done this, this, and this, and she's being criticized." Well, think how you criticize. I was chiding my fellow press persons. There'd been some terrible things written about her, outrageous. And I said, think how you treated Jackie Kennedy. Think how you made fun of Bess Truman. Think how you made fun and laughed at Mrs. Lyndon Johnson at first because of her accent, you know, and things like that. I mean, the press has always been terrible to every First Lady, but they were particularly bad to Nancy Reagan because she was pretty, she seemed too smooth and she was rather cool and so on. Anyway, this article changed my life, and of course I had no idea, that being a journalist, that I was going to suddenly be propelled into a government job. Mrs. Reagan read it, the administration read it, they were grateful to me, I guess, because they thought I'd rescued a very bad situation. I certainly had never consulted them when I wrote it. This was not done at any prompt, by anyone's prompting, just my own feistiness. And so, anyway, that was in November, and the next thing I know, I was on assignment in Brazil with Town and Country magazine, where I was writing an article on Bahia. And when I got home, my mother said, "The White House has called, and Mr. Deaver." And I said, "Well, why didn't you give my number in Brazil?" Mother said, "Oh, well, I didn't think it was important." So, mothers are wonderful. So my darling mother didn't realize that my life was going to change immediately. And I finally got hold of Mr. Deaver, and he said, "Lucky, I've been trying to reach you to ask you if you'd like to become the president's chief of protocol." And I didn't even hesitate. My husband was in Africa with David Rockefeller on an assignment at Chase Bank. Nobody was home. I didn't consult anybody. I said, "I would love it." And that's how it began. And I don't know why, I just knew that it was something perfect for me. And I never had any reason to regret it. I felt that everything I'd ever learned in my whole life came together in this. And I loved working for Ronald Reagan. He was a very distant president, He's not someone that you would just go in, put your feet up on, and, you know, have a nice social conversation with, but he was one of the most pleasant human beings to work with you've ever seen. And I enjoyed every minute of my association with him. I also worked, as you know, that job, you worked for the Vice President as well. I worked for Vice President Bush. But most of all, I worked also for Secretary of State Shultz. So I had three extraordinary human beings to work for, men of integrity, men of probity. You may like or dislike their politics, but as human beings, they were extraordinarily wonderful people to work for. So I had nothing but a very positive feeling about my experience. People are always asking me about some of the other people in the administration. I'm happy to go into that, but I'm not going to do it with a television camera.
Could you say a word about your, as the first question indicates, about your feeling the first time you met him of President Reagan's quality or candidate Reagan's quality as a leader?
Well, I met him first as a would-be candidate when I observed him as a journalist. And I remember that everybody then was saying, particularly, this was the Women's Press Club, and the ladies, friends of mine, were saying, oh, I mean, why do they have this lightweight? Why do they have this guy? You know, I mean, he's not going to ever amount to anything as a presidential candidate. Well, he fooled them. And I must say, when I met him, when I saw him that day, I already saw a man of great leadership capacity. The man has something when you're in his presence. And he conveyed something, obviously, to the American people, or he wouldn't have been elected and reelected, and could have probably been reelected the third time. So my impression of him was a warm and good one, and that this man is a leader. Now, I didn't know anything about him as an intellect, but being myself a conservative, basically, although I disagreed with him profoundly on the abortion issue. I just have to quickly say that I'm pro-choice and very strongly pro-choice.
Didn't keep you from being a part.
No, and I thought it might, so I told them right away when they offered me the job. That was the first thing. Mike Deaver said to me, do you have any skeletons in your closet? And I imagine, but it's interesting that what came to my mind first was my position on abortion. Now, that's because I think that it's considered a little bit, I think it's become an issue where people are embarrassed, and I think it's ridiculous, to admit the way they feel about it. And it's not quite fashionable to be pro-choice. It's also not fashionable to be so strongly anti-abortion. I'm not quite sure what is fashionable in this issue. Maybe there's no way to be fashionable, thank goodness. But I think you have to have your convictions on something like this. Anyway, the president had his, I had mine. The president was sincere in his convictions. He believed abortion was murder. I believe, of course, that it was a matter of morality and religion and that sort of thing. And therefore, when they asked me if I had any skeletons in my closet, though, I felt I had to confess this. Mike Deaver said to me, well, the president feels very strongly, but this has nothing to do with you being chief of protocol. And I think Mike Deaver made that decision. I don't think it was ever kicked up to the president. In any case, it never came up again. Nobody ever taxed me with it. And when I was interviewed time and again by newspapers and reporters, I always stated my position, and I refused to back down on it. So that's that. And as for the president, he never raised the issue with me. The other question that came up was a question of my background. I'm of Lebanese origin, and it just so happened that Mrs. Annenberg, my predecessor, had appointed a Mr. Nassif, her deputy, and he also was of Lebanese origin. And I thought that was just a coincidence, of course, but I still thought the president should be aware of it in case this caused him any problems. And Mike Deaver dismissed that immediately and said, the president just doesn't think that way. He's just not interested in your ethnic origin. And whether that's going to be advantageous to him or disadvantageous, it's a question of suitability and ability. And that, I never heard another word about that either. Except, which you'll see in the book, I mean, it comes up, but not in the context of the president's reactions to me of what was right.
Mrs. Roosevelt, may I ask a question that sometimes comes at the end of our discussions, but that it would be, I think, of interest to all of us to hear now, and that is, how do you feel that historians will judge the president? His popularity has dropped noticeably since he left office. Popularity of some presidents has gone up, and so one wonders how history will deal with the president in the years ahead.
It's hard to tell, of course, but my own gut feeling, and just based on what I know about him, is this. First, I think revisionist history is always very, very fashionable right after a presidency. And right now, revisionist history has the president painted as a sort of a dimwit who was manipulated by unscrupulous aides and a strong, manipulative wife. And that's just not true. I mean, part of, you know, this is the image now. But in truth, I think the president will go down as a rather great president. And the reason is, what I saw, I'm not going to talk about domestic policies because I'm not well-versed in them and I did not get involved in them. So what I saw was the foreign policy side of it. And on the foreign policy side, between the president and George Shultz, this last 8 years, I mean, the Reagan presidency can be very proud. And this is what I would like to then summarize, if I may. As I look at each part of the world, I think that in most parts of the world was better off following the Reagan presidency than at the beginning of it. And I'll just take you around the world briefly and tell you why I think that, and I'm sure you'll challenge me, but I'd like to say why I think. First and foremost, Europe. Aside from, I can't dismiss, obviously, the wonderful good fortune of President Reagan to have had Mr. Gorbachev as his counterpoint in the Soviet Union. And I do not play down how important Mr. Gorbachev is and was. But the two of them came together at just the right moment. And certainly what we've seen happen in the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe, I don't need to go into. All of us know that the world has changed incredibly. And I believe that that is in part due to President Reagan and his policies. Policy of strength, peace through strength, which I think was a very wise one. And a lot of people don't agree, but I think that SDI threat was very effective. Then the other part of the European equation, the unity of Western Europe, was a very important part of our policy. And people forget about it because they just sort of take it for granted. But there was a great deal that went on that was involved, we were involved in. And we were the spiritual, and we led leaders of that, as well as a lot of impetus came from Europe itself, of course, but we certainly pushed it along. Then, moving on to the Far East, where, despite what happened in Tiananmen Square, I think what we did in our policies in China, and that I will address more because I was so involved with so many of our visitors that came from China, and you could see the good guys and the bad guys even as we did it. But I think our policies were right, and I think our attempt to build a very much better relationship with China was definitely the right one. Not only that, I think the attempts by our administration to encourage democratic and economic liberalization in China were the right ones, and so right, in fact, that they did indeed lead to Tiananmen Square. And I'm, alas, being right can also be a tragedy. In this case it was, but I think in the end it's going to all come back to a pursuit of democracy in China. I think we just now are in a bad period, and I hope that the situation in China will improve for the Chinese and our own relationship. Now, to move on, the Far East, of course, was where Secretary Shultz always just beamed when he had to deal with the Far East, because it was such a happy picture, basically. Even Japan, because actually Japan prospered because of what we encouraged them to do, which was to forget militarism and encourage economic development. And they did it so well that now we're paying for that. But in any case, that was our policy. And all of the Far East prospered and became better, as and the whole situation in the Far East improved in the Reagan years. Now, South America, while not certainly a perfect picture, God knows, but still, if you look at it, at the beginning of the Reagan administration, there were so many totalitarian governments and authoritarian governments. By the end of it, there was only one. Well, Nicaragua, but that now has changed, obviously, but that's now Cuba. And so now the map is all one color. And it's all democratic, for better, for worse. Some of them are not doing too well, but this was the policy we encouraged. This is what we tried to do, and we eventually succeeded. And Africa, which is not exactly a brilliant page, but still, things were better in Africa, particularly South Africa, when we left than when we began. And the Middle East is where I think, of course, we were patently a failure, and so has every administration in the immediate past been, and I'm afraid it's the Waterloo of every administration. So that more or less sums up the world as very quickly. And I think that maybe is...
Yeah, fine. Why don't we adjourn the public meeting that we have and turn to the off-the-record session. Sean Moore has been giving 30-minute interviews to the media, and so this is probably in keeping with that pattern. Not that Mrs. Roosevelt is going to the Sugar Bowl, but...
Well, I hope that's sufficient. Did I say anything terribly indiscreet?
No. The book, I just say a word while we're making the transition. The book is such an interesting treatise, and you might think of it as you raise your questions, because part one deals with Mrs. Roosevelt's life and works. It does do some retrospective discussions after having started with the actual appointment and the choice that was made when she became Keeper of the Gate. But it tells about the Tennessee Hills and the ambassador and the family background. Part three is, from our standpoint, along with part four, probably the part of the book that bears most directly on the Reagan oral history for us. And part three is entitled The Cast of Characters, chapter 21, Ronald Reagan, chapter 22, Nancy Reagan, An Enigma, 23, George Shultz, The Beloved Buddha, and 24, A Plague of Courtiers, which is a very striking and illuminating account of Mrs. Roosevelt's relations with the White House staff, the relationships between the departments and the White House have been a dominant concern of the Miller Center in all our studies. Part four goes much further than the brief tour d'horizon, which we've heard about foreign policy around the world, and includes such chapters as The Russians Are Coming, Arms Control and Apple Pie, The Guy is a PR Genius, China, Asia, the Middle East, Africa, Europe, and the last chapter, one that certainly will be welcome to some, maybe all of us who are here today, on being a woman. We can either continue with some of our questions or we can open it up as you wish.
That's up to you. Would you like me I'd be happy to take questions and find out what people are really interested in, or I can just touch on some of these. I'll do whatever you like.
Why don't you touch on just a few?
All right. My initial impressions of Ronald Reagan. Well, I have to tell you, he's about the most charming man you've ever met in your life. I'm sure some of you have met him, no? He's just one of those human beings that the minute you're around him, he has an aura of happiness and a man very much at ease with himself. He makes you feel good. And I don't mean that. I hate it when I read these things about, you know, Dr. Feelgood and all that stuff. But he was a man of presence. He didn't have a lightweight feeling about him at all. Now, he didn't have the gravitas of Secretary Shultz, who you really, I don't know, you just had a feeling when you met him that here was a man so serious that you wanted to sort of sometimes jolly him up. And he did have a wonderful side, which we'll go into in a minute. But the president just always seemed to have the right degree of whatever it was that was necessary when he met a world leader, let's say. If he were greeting a rather reserved leader, he instinctively didn't presume or try to slap him on the back or anything like that. I mean, just a little body language that I always watched. When we brought in a Latino who would say, "Ah, mi amigo Ronald," and go like that and beat him on the back, and he would beat him back on the back. You see, and he became Latin, and maybe that was part of the actor quality in him. But he always managed to give the right degree back to the person that he was talking to. I don't know if I'm saying this very well or not, but it's a quality that made for people to like him and respect him and warm to him, so that every world leader, I did not take a single leader to him except for Mugabe of Zimbabwe. He's the only man that Ronald Reagan did not charm. In the entire 7 years, they would go into the Oval Office always a little nervous, a little apprehensive, not knowing what they were, and usually they had some maybe harsh things they wanted to say to him, and so on, and they would say them because the president didn't inhibit people, but they would come away because he somehow had a way of turning it all, so that I guess Ronald Reagan just looked at every person as a challenge. He was going to make them like him no matter what. And he did. But he didn't make Mugabe. I don't know. He just never could get past that man. He was just determined not to like Ronald Reagan. I think some people approach the president with a supercilious attitude. Aha, he's a lightweight, he's an actor, a cowboy. And they soon changed. I noticed there was a lot of change. From the first economic summit, which I wasn't present at, that was in Canada, that was before I was chief of protocol, but I heard about it. And they were particularly, I think then it was Trudeau, who was rather supercilious anyway, and not one of my favorites, nor Ronald Reagan's, I might add. he had a sort of intellectual disdain for the president, because of course the president is no intellectual, never presumed or pretended to be. And he apparently, they sort of, I don't know if they ganged up on him or not, but I gather that first economic summit was not a smashing success. But then after that, and this is where I came in, the next one was at Paris, and of course Mitterrand was prepared to be as disdainful as he's known to be, and you know how French can be sometimes anyway. But he, by the end of that, I noticed that there was a great, they seemed to be getting along, and they were grudgingly respectful of each other, I would say. And by the third economic summit, it was quite different. Ronald Reagan was accepted and obviously the leader, even as opposed to Margaret Thatcher, who was the other one, who certainly had great leadership qualities. And so he, time and again, fooled people, I think. And they came prepared to be contemptuous and disdainful, and they went away respectful and feeling that they'd been in the presence of a man who was a leader. I don't think anyone, including Ronald Reagan, will ever accuse him of being a great intellectual. I'm not sure that's also absolutely essential to being a great president. It is nice if you can combine leadership qualities and the ability to stir and move your fellow citizens and at the same time have a deep intellect. And I might point out that Theodore Roosevelt was one of those. a little family bragging. But they don't come very often. And I think that President Reagan, as a leader, and this is the question that I'm addressing, was a terrific one.
Could I just interrupt for one second? In the book you talk about his calm in coming into a meeting when Nancy Reagan's surgery was expected and other events. Kennedy was praised. Mr. Sorensen's brother and Arthur Schlesinger and others have praised President Kennedy at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis in leaving the room to meet a president of another country, coming back and not a hair was ruffled. And I was reminded of that as I read your description of his calm.
Yeah. Well, when he was going to fire Alexander Haig. Yes, that was quite a dramatic day, and I was over there to bring six ambassadors to present their credentials to the president. We did it one right after the other rather than bother him every other day with it. We would organize it that way. So when I arrived at the White House, it was around midday, I think, or a little after, the place was just awash with tension. I mean, you could just feel that something was terribly wrong. I knew that Mr. Haig was on the skids. We all knew that, but I didn't know what had been decided. There had been a cabinet meeting. And apparently, the president decided to fire him. And having made that decision, I can't remember now. I have to go to my own book to find out, because it's just a question of the sequence of events. But what I remember is when I went in to the Oval Office, having been told by his aides that this was what was happening, the president was totally calm and unruffled, as if nothing had happened, smiling, charming, and I brought in the first ambassador, perfect. The next five, as we, you know, you usher them in, you go through a ceremony, they leave, each one separately. Six of them, the president never gave any indication that he was disturbed about anything, and then he went out and announced it after that to the press that he had done I think he put it, the Secretary of State had resigned. And I think Mr. Hay, I don't know that he tells us in his book, but he wasn't expecting to have his resignation accepted. And it was accepted with such alacrity, because by that time the White House staff really loathed poor Mr. Hay. I felt kind of sorry for him as all this was happening, because I saw the humiliations that the White House staff were subjecting him to. And it was really not a pretty picture. The president was totally unaware of that side of it, and that's the sort of thing that he's been criticized for now, for not being aware. But even secretaries of state don't like to bother presidents about personal slights and indignities. And they don't do it. I mean, Secretary Shultz wouldn't have gone to the president. And I certainly never did. And as you know, I have a chapter on what it's like to deal with self-important, puffed-up White House aides. And it was really a revelation to me. I came in an innocent, but I won't go into that now. You wanted me to talk about the president. My perception of him never particularly changed all through the 7 years. He was exactly what I saw. And I don't think, everybody keeps saying we've got to get through that veil, we've got to get underneath this and underneath that. I don't think there's anything to get underneath. I think it's just the way he is. He was what you saw. A man of wonderful ability, interpersonal relationships. A man with very strongly held convictions. Some of them, I think, arguably simplistic. But there it is. And but that's the way he was. And he was not, as someone characterized him as I believe it was a Democrat, naturally, who said that he was an amiable dunce. And that is not what Ronald Reagan was. He was canny. He was no fool. And he knew what he was doing. He knew what he wanted to achieve. And there was no way, nobody was guiding him or telling him. He knew what he wanted and what he thought was right for the country. Whether it was right or not, that's very easy to argue about, and God knows we're going to be arguing about that for a long time. And I didn't agree with everything he thought was right for the country.
Nobody was guiding him, not even Nancy.
Nancy was not an intellectual either, and is not. And she's not also a very profound person. She's an intelligent woman, again. Better educated than I had. Better educated than I had realized, and she read a lot. Not heavy, profound, but she was well. She liked to be well informed, and I think she had good instincts about a lot of things, more liberal than the president, perhaps. Maybe I would say, I consider myself a moderate conservative. I am not an ideologue, and I don't go along with the right wing. I just want to put my own definitions right on the table, because then you can attack me from whatever basis. But I would call myself a Rockefeller Republican, for better or for worse. That's what they used to. And that was interesting that the president took me on, because I never hid that I wasn't an ideological right-wing conservative. Anyway, Nancy maybe was a little more pragmatic than the president. Maybe being in Washington changed her. I don't know what she was like before, except for that one time I interviewed her, but we didn't talk profoundly about politics in those days. And I have no idea what her deep convictions were. I think she did whatever was right for her president, and I think that's the way Mrs. Bush is behaving too, I might add. I think Mrs. Bush doesn't agree with the president on the abortion issue, but she'll never say so. You know, I mean, wives of presidents tend to be supportive of their husbands, and you can understand what catastrophe that would be in the evening if they were out disagreeing all day long. And Mrs. Reagan was an old-fashioned wife who adored him and thought only about him and what was right for him and what was his place in history. But I think she had an instinct, and she was in better contact with people who were influential in the press and the media and the people that are going to form a lot of the public perceptions of the president. And so she brought that back to the president. That was something she could contribute. And I would say that, and I was talking to you about this earlier, about Secretary Shultz, was a very important factor in Mrs. Reagan's thinking. She respected the Secretary of State more, perhaps, than anyone that worked for Ronald Reagan. And that speaks well for Mrs. Reagan, because I must tell you that of all the people that worked for the president, there were decisions based on, you know, quick takes. He was a thorough man and a very serious man. Well, that to bring that back to Nancy Reagan, he also was a very good judge of character and of people. And he liked women very, very much. He respected them, and he treated them as equals, which isn't always true of everybody in the Reagan administration. And he was very, I don't think it was deliberate and clever, which is easy to say that, but I think it was just his gut instinct. And he was a very perceptive man, that the foreign policy he wanted to pursue toward the Soviets, he had to win over the President of the United States, and that was the way to do that, was obviously to win over as well the most influential person on that president, which was Mrs. Reagan. And I think she respected him enormously. She liked him. She also realized that here was a man who was not manipulative and was not going to use her husband for his greater glory or gain. And that was true of George Shultz. He always deferred to the president, and they had a marvelous relationship, I think, as a result. And you will see that in Mrs. Reagan's memoirs, very few people come out all right. I was so grateful that I wasn't even mentioned, except as a friend. And most of us were grateful. But the people that she did mention were the ones that she felt had not served the president well. And the one she singled out for real praise was George Shultz, and rightly so. Anyway, George Shultz won her confidence, and I believe that that helped her to guide her thinking on the question of the Soviets and so on. But I think the president had an open mind on the question of the Soviet Union. He called it the evil empire. I have to confess to you, I thought he was quite right. It was an evil empire. And as we look back on it, I don't see how anybody could deny that it was an evil empire. And I always laugh when everybody says the so-called, quotes, evil empire. It was a very evil and horrible way of life. And we see now what the Soviet, what the Russian people have had to pay for that myth of socialism or communism. Anyway, the president was well prepared to greet Gorbachev halfway. And as he had said, and I think he still says it, the previous Soviet leaders just kept dying on him. And he'd start to try to do something with one, and then there'd be a funeral. So most of that time was spent sending the vice president and the secretary of state to funerals, and then trying to gauge the next atmosphere of the next leader. And it was only when Gorbachev came in that things truly changed. And the president realized, as did Secretary of State, that we were on to a whole new phase in our relationship with the Soviet Union. And certainly it was. And I think that Mrs. Reagan and the president both influenced each other in a way. If you know, I mean, I think that they have such a close relationship they are, Mrs. Reagan would be able to influence him as no other person could, and naturally, Secretary Shultz had an enormous influence on the president on the question of the relationship with the Soviet Union. The secretary saw very early on that it was important, and I mean, not that it was important, but that it was important to meet Gorbachev halfway. And that's what we did.
Mrs. Roosevelt, we have an opportunity on the staff to visit with you before and after this session, and so some of our questions can be addressed in that way. I think having answered the less significant questions, now we ought to open it, if we could, to get some of the better questions. Bill Horbley.
Were you aware of any instance where the Palace Guard withheld information from the President?
Oh, Lord. I don't know whether I'm going to get in a lot of trouble saying this or not, but I think the Palace Guard never wanted to tell the President very much, because they had this rather smug idea that they really knew, and they often, I think, withheld information from the President. But I don't think it was, I mean, it wasn't exactly a sinister thing. I'm trying to say this in a way, I think it's just the way it was. These people that worked for the President, and you were talking about the Palace Guard now. For example, I don't think George Shultz ever withheld information from the President. I think whatever he felt was important to bring to the President's attention, he would, for better or for worse. And there were others like him, Mack Baldridge, Cap Weinberger. These were men of great probity and great integrity, and they were fine Americans and are. The White House staff is another breed, and they're not men usually well-educated necessarily, and not they're men who've gotten there through the political process. They're people who helped the President get elected, and they're totally unqualified to be giving judgments to the President. So if there was something they didn't want to tell the President, they didn't feel they had to tell the President. Their attitude was totally different. And so an awful lot, I think, that isn't just President Reagan. I think that happens in every administration. Some more than others, because, I mean, a president can start out by saying, now I want everything brought to my attention, and I want this and I want that, and that can start out that way. But in the end, I think it also happens that just when you're there and you see the sheer volume of the work that goes on and the volume of papers and the amount that has to be distilled before a president could possibly, you know, focus, then it's the judgment of those men as to what's distilled and what gets to the presidential ear and eye depends on the caliber of those men. And that's what's the problem. I think it's the caliber of so many of the people who occupy the position who don't have sense enough to know what should be brought to the President's attention and think they know better and assume certain roles that they don't have the right to assume. I was horrified by that.
Next question. Bill Wimple.
Do you suppose it was just dumb luck for President Reagan or the country that George Shultz got into the position that he held, and his probity, character, and abilities? Were we just lucky, or is there some way that things like that happen because someone like President Reagan knows who to look for?
I think that was President Reagan's own instinct. He wanted Shultz from the beginning, and he got talked out of it by these so-called geniuses who selected Secretary of State Haig, which was a disaster.
not by Cap Weinberger.
Well, I don't know who it was. I really don't. I don't know who talked him out of it, but he really wanted Schultz in the beginning. And it's interesting because Schultz was regarded as a moderate Republican, and as Secretary Haig was regarded, I think, as more ideological. I don't know that, though. I'm not sure about that. Because, I wasn't around at that part of it, so I can't speak with real authority. This is just what you hear. I heard that the president had originally wanted Schultz. And so when Haig finally did resign, fired or whatever, the president got the man he wanted.
Next question.
To follow up on the previous question and comment, it gets into the, you mentioned the vast amount of organization and work that has to be covered, and we have heard from others that the president gave a very sizable amount of delegation. Now, if there is a delegation, is there not a probability that a large portion of the information shouldn't go to the president? The president has delegated the function, and did it work that way? Or do you think they deliberately held back things that they didn't want him to know?
Well, you see, that's putting a more sinister thing on it than I don't think there were many sinister people. I mean, I think there were some inept.
Well, that's the question.
There were inept people, and there were people who, just because of their intellectual limitations, didn't make maybe good judgments. But I don't think there were many sinister people involved. These people, even people that I had troubles with, like Mike Deaver, are patriots. I mean, they are people who love their country, and they don't see that they are doing something that might be a unworthy. I incidentally have sort of made my peace with Mike Deaver, even after having a lot of difficulty with him, because I've come to, one has to have a certain amount of Christian spirit in all this, and I thought he'd suffered enough, and I think he suffered very much for his arrogance and so on, and I think his punishment has already been done, and I've made up with it. But I'd certainly had my troubles. And people like that, like Dick Darman, like Ed Meese and so on, well, they're very different, of course. I mean, Mr. Meese was, I suppose, a little bit of a disorganized person and rather bumbly, but he certainly was a man of integrity. I mean, I know people will challenge that, but what I mean is he was as patriotic in his feeling about this country as anyone, and he wanted to do nothing but serve this country and serve his president well. He didn't, perhaps, in the end, but there are a lot of human frailties involved in all this. But then you get someone who is brilliant like Dick Darman, but who's also very, very arrogant and thinks he knows everything. And maybe he failed to bring something to the attention of the president because he thought he knew better than the president. Who knows? There are many reasons why these things don't. But if you delegate, as you said, then you have to assume that the person to whom it is delegated has sense enough to know what to bring to you and isn't so intellectually arrogant that he thinks he can solve it without you if you're the President of the United States. So you have to deal with intellectual arrogance, you have to deal with incompetence, you have to deal with bumbling types, you have to deal with people who don't really know what they're doing. And all these people get things delegated. And then you get very competent people sometimes, and you're lucky.
Any questions in the outer room, or any questions around the table?
I have a question here. I think it's wonderful that we can hear all about Ronald Reagan, and I'm a great admirer of him, and have been for a long time. But I would like to hear what your job was at the Blair House, and how involved you were with, I guess, state and that sort of thing.
There's one chapter with 21 functions.
Okay. I'm also very interested in the preservation of Virginia, and I'd like to know if you had, what your role was in the preservation of the Blair House.
Well, of course, the Blair House is a national monument, but just as what happened, just to briefly tell you a little bit, the house was allowed for 20 years by successive Congresses to go into disrepair. No money was appropriated for just even day-to-day maintenance. An outrage. That's the first thing. Then, when a gas furnace blew, we had the Tunisian president in the house, and, you know, that could have been an international incident. And then when the chandelier fell on the principal bed, thank God there wasn't a principal in it, we thought that international relations demanded that we close the house, because we were going to have an incident sooner or later, so we closed it. Well, that was the beginning of my troubles. Next thing was to get the money to do what a feasibility study had already been done. And it was going to cost $9 million, they thought. Well, that went to the Congress, and with the letter from the president and encouragement, Mike Deaver, incidentally, was wonderful about it. So was Don Regan when he succeeded him. I got nothing but support in this project. But the Congress absolutely died when they said, what? A house? Restoring a house? $9 million? No, you know. State Department budget? You know how they love to play with that. Well, then a man of great genius. Now, this is where you really appreciate a really bright political appointee. It's a guy called Dick Haas. You've never heard of him, maybe. Anyway, he came to me. He said, you know, I really care about this place. It's important to keep it. It's so important for the country. And motivated by his patriotism, he said to me, I've got a suggestion for you. Get it out of the State Department budget. Transfer the building's ownership, even temporarily, to the General Services Administration, which has an enormous budget, zillions. Nobody will even notice it. And in the State Department budget, it was a huge thing. So I went to my superiors with this idea, and they all encouraged it. The president, with a stroke of the pen, I think, was able to do it. Transferred the ownership to the GSA, and then the budget went to Congress as a GSA request. And that was really very clever on the part of Mr. House. I owe him, we all owe him Blair House. Anyway, even so, there was a crusty senator called Senator Abner, who incidentally was of Lebanese-American origin. And the next thing I know, he'd cut the appropriation from $8.6 million to $3 million. And I really was upset, as you can imagine. So I trotted myself down to his office. I talked to his aides, and the aides were very disdainful of me and of the whole project. And they said, this is an outrage. The senator will have nothing to do with this, and he's not going to restore any of the money. $3 million, you've got to do it. And anyway, why don't you tear it down? It's a disgrace to the country. And build something modern and new. This was what I was told. So I said, over my dead body, and I will make such a noise that you will wish you'd never met me. Then I went to Senator Abner myself, and there was this crusty old fellow, and he was really very negative, and I talked to him. I said, but Senator, why have you done this? You know we can't get anywhere with $3 million. It can't be done. And I explained. He said, back where I come from, one of the Dakotas, I forgot, the South or North. He said, back where I come from, $9 million to do over a house is an outrage. An outrage. The taxpayers shouldn't have to pay for that. He went on like that. And finally, I pointed out to him it was 110 rooms, it was four houses, and we went on. I didn't get anywhere I could see, and finally I looked at him as I was leaving, and I said, Senator, I just don't see how you have the heart to be so mean to another Lebanese-American. And though I've tried everything else, I'll try that one. Ethnic, you know, the Lebanese mafia. I was going to try anything. Well, it worked. He did. He did restore the money. But he said to me as I left, well, he says, I have to discuss this with my committee. I knew there was no committee, but I didn't say anything. And I said, yes, sir, please. And so the next thing I knew, the word came back that the money had been restored. And I guess that was one plus that I got out of being a Lebanese. A Lebanese Argentine. Anyway, so the house was done. But the other thing that was in the legislation was that no money could be used for redecorating. So the $9 million was for structural, and it was profound, the structural changes and the redoing, the rewiring, the whole thing was done over. The house was gutted and started back to go, and all of it was restored perfectly. It is a beautiful house. I'm so proud of it. A beautiful series of houses, obviously. Anyway, we had to raise in the private sector $5 million. Well, actually, I had to raise $4 million. That was what my instructions were. And that's what was decided. Then I decided, well, if I'm going to go for four, I'll go for five and have $1 million as an endowment. And that's what we left behind. There is an endowment of over $1 million, and we're going to add to it so that the house will never fall in disrepair again. We now have a board of directors of a fund called the Blair House Restoration Fund. I happen to sit on that board. There are 10 others. Ann Armstrong is the chairman. And we have a very distinguished board of women and men who care about this house. And they will not let it, we will not let it go into disrepair again. That's all. And we'll go out and raise the money if it's necessary again. Right now, it's in great shape, and the $1 million is gathering interest. We're not spending it.
5 minutes on your job?
My job? About the heads of state.
What kind of job did you get with?
Well, very. I think the chief of protocol spends more time with the guest, the head of state that's visiting, than any other single person. Because you're with them from morning until you tuck them into bed practically at night. And you see them in a more informal circumstances than anyone else. I mean, naturally, when they go to meet the President of the United States, they're on their best behavior. They certainly never get cross or testy with their aides or anything like that in front of the President. But you see them as they really are. And I mean, I had everything from heads of state who brought their wives and their mistresses and their ex-mistresses all in one trip, and you had to deal with that. I had the Zairean entourage who complained that my protocol officers, some very beautiful girls, by the way, but they said their breasts were too small. They didn't think they were very pretty. I mean, you get all kinds of things. I mean, not that they had anything to do with them, mind you. This was just observing them at a distance. And then complained that I didn't look after them the way the French chief of protocol did. He provided call girls. That's the extreme of one extreme. Then I had these absolutely wonderful visitors like the Prime Minister of Canada and Mrs. Mulroney, who were absolutely delightful. I had these wonderful visits of people like Gorbachev, which were exciting and thrilling, and I was with them a lot, and I saw them again with their aides as they behaved off the record as well as on the record. And people say to me, were people very different from the way they behave, say, in their public stance, in their private stance? Actually, not a lot. A head of state that's won, say, by a democratic election is a guy who knows how to go out and charm people and get people to vote for him. So he's pretty attractive anyway, like Felipe Gonzalez of Spain and Prime Minister Hawke of Australia. These are men who have been tested and gone out and won their elections. And incidentally, both of them were socialists. Both of them disagreed profoundly with President Reagan on economic policies and things like that. But in the end, it was they who bent to President Reagan's way of thinking. It's very interesting. And not only that, they all formed these great friendships. And I would see them come the first trip a little bit pestered. And by the end, they were warm friends, and they trusted each other. And that's another thing that Reagan inspired, was trust. People really believed what he said to them. And I, actually, the president thought he always spoke the truth. I mean, he was not a manipulative, duplicitous man. People could see that right away. So he had good relationships with heads of state. Anyway, as to my own participation in all this, I don't want to overemphasize anything, because I mean, it's presumptuous of me. But what I saw and witnessed, which is in the book, were obviously I saw human frailties, and I saw people when they were upset. I'll never forget the Mexican president, De La Madrid, who came and was, this was a trip of hope. We were really wanting to improve our relationship with Mexico so badly. And that day, Jack Anderson chose to write this vituperative, nasty column, which really made it sound as if he was had his hand in the till, was a dishonest. And so here he was, newly elected, on the platform that he was going to try to clean up Mexican politics. And to all that I've been able to see, he did try, and he left no richer than when he came in, which is unusual for, you know, Mexico. But this was a new look, and De La Madrid was the beginning of it. Well, instead of giving it a little push and sort of making what happened was that this article was so ugly and turned things so bad that it really put a pall on the visit. And De La Madrid kept saying to me, I don't understand why the president can't publicly make a statement denying or disabusing or disassociating himself with this Anderson column. Well, he couldn't understand, and I was the one who suddenly had to explain this, that in our press, it would just give it more credibility, it would give it more credence, and it's not something the president would normally or could do very easily. He could only show by his respect and admiration for him that this was something to be disregarded. And another time, I had President Alfonsine of Argentina almost, you know, really, really upset because he had been seated at the state dinner, which I might add, I will tell you, I did not do that seating, but I sort of fudged it up, I guess, in the book, didn't I? I don't remember. Anyway, he was very upset because it was a terrible mistake and an unusual mistake. A woman from Argentina was seated next to him, a very famous one called Amalita de Fortabat, who is a wonderful woman, a great philanthropist from Argentina, and someone that I know very well. But I didn't know she was suddenly added to the list at the last minute by the White House, and I never saw the list again. And Mrs. Reagan did not want anybody to see the seating after it was done, and she finished with it. And so I didn't see the seating, or I probably would have said something about it. And seated next to the president of Argentina was the banker of his political enemy. So that was a really bad moment. And he handled it very graciously that evening, but the next day was hell to pay. And there's an example of me not telling the president. I didn't. I mean, I just didn't see any point in making his life miserable over something that had already happened, that I tried to then I tried to unravel it. And I did tell the Secretary of State, but I didn't tell the President, and I didn't task Mrs. Reagan with it, because it was done, and all I would have done was just get everybody's backup.
We have another important event. Mrs. Roosevelt has kindly promised to autograph copies of her book, and I'll accompany her out if you remain seated for just a moment. During the course of her discussion, however, it occurred to me she might promise us to do one other thing when Blair House and the other projects are finished. We're thinking, Mrs. Roosevelt, that wonderful as that wing of new wing is, we'd very much like to build a wing on the other side of the and with just a flip of the wrist, I would think we could handle that. We're very, very grateful to you for a most exciting discussion.